U.S. courtroom panel. We have panels all over the building, so it's good to get started. I'm absolutely delighted to be sitting with Judge Carolyn King, who served so marvelously as our chief judge and, more importantly, served as chair of the Judicial Conference Executive Committee. And she was the chief during Katrina, so she gets special accolades for weathering that whole matter marvelously. So good to sit with you, Carolyn. And of course, coming all the way from uptown New Orleans, here's Judge Higginson, who is anchoring the panel, but it's a delight to sit. We've got an interesting mix of cases this week, and we look forward to the oral argument. I think counsel are veterans, so you know the rules. So we'll call the first case up. So, number 23-10735, United States versus Thomas. Mr. Page, you're a veteran of this matter.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My plan today is to address the waiver and then proceed to the merits, but I'll be happy to be redirected. The government's position on the waiver, Your Honors, today is that there is no statutory maximum governing the severity of the conditions of supervised release. I think that's a surprising result when we look at the care that Congress used in crafting 3583D2, which shows significant concern with protecting defendants against the risk of punitive and over-severe conditions of supervised release.
But you wanted a plea here, and so you negotiated it, and paragraph 12 is the waiver that you agreed to. So you got to fit the appeal into an exception. Which is the exception?
Exception is a sentence exceeding the statutory maximum.
And just, you have a case that says, I tend to think of attacks on, and yours included, attacks on probation conditions. They sort of fit under 3583, sometimes vagueness arguments. But it's a little hard for me to think that that's a stat max issue.
Well, this court's precedent, if we look at Bond and we look at Cortez, which provide the general definition for the term statutory maximum in the waiver context, say that it is the upper limit of punishment provided for violations of a statute legislatively specified.
But you're generally talking about the statute, not conditions of probation. What's your case that would hold that the conditions of probation fit within the terms of the statute for purposes of exceeding a max?
2 points about that. The case is United States versus Higgins. The most specific case is United States versus Higgins. United States versus Higgins, it first rejects an oral written conflict, and then it says, in order to make sure that this challenge is not outside the scope of the waiver, we need to determine that it's not above the statutory maximum, and then says, essentially, that 3583D is the statutory maximum for measuring the severity of the terms of supervised release.
So you're saying stat max is equivalent to unlawful?
No.
No?
No, no, Your Honor. I'm saying that stat max is equivalent to the most punishment that you can get for a violation for a particular crime.
Right, but conditions of probation, they aren't like, oh, you get more prison time. They're trying to help the person rehabilitate. So here it's, you know, we need to make sure everyone knows that you've had the embezzlement problems. And they're going to know, we're going to know, and we're going to get you through this. So I don't think of it as sort of adding punishment.
Well, whether we call it punishment or whether we call it tough love assistance, we can still describe it as more or less severe. And we can still, and a normal speaker of English would still describe a more severe condition of supervised release as subject to a maximum, the same way.
All you have to do is convince us it's ambiguous, right?
That's right. That's right. Ambiguity is construed against the drafter. If the government wishes to avoid this problem in the future, they can contract around that by saying, for example, the defendant waives any objection or waives any appeal of any of the standard conditions of supervised release or any, and then the macros that prevail in each district, and just
I'll just tell you, I have trouble getting to the place where there's a negotiated plea like here that's laid all out with a waiver, with the language, and then we get to an appeal, somebody who bargained for what they got then wants to say, gotcha, you know, that's tough. You know, a jury trial, whatever, nobody weighs in, but I mean, to come in a negotiator, you say, well, it could have contracted around it. We get all these appeal waivers. Well, what is the point of having the waivers if we're going to litigate that the waiver doesn't mean what it says?
I think
there's nothing in the record that shows ambiguity or lack of clarity when the district court was meeting this out, is it?
In fact, if you look at the sentencing transcript, I mean, right at...
Let me ask you a more direct question. What is it precisely you're asking this panel to hold in this case?
I'm asking the panel to hold that the term statutory maximum, unless the plea agreement says otherwise, means the upper limit of punishment specified for a violation of a crime, and in the context of the severity of conditions of supervised release, that means 3583D2, because there is no...
That's a mouthful, Mr. Page. I mean, that's a mouthful. You ain't even stop with a comma or semicolon. Okay, that's a mouthful. And none of that was presented to the district court as an issue below when it was done, right? I mean, you're asking for that manifest holding out of this case. So I'm missing something in the briefing where that's dredged up to where we can't get around having to come down with that kind of holding. I mean, I know it's on your wish list, but I'm just saying, you know.
Let me say it more briefly.
Right.
What I'm trying to say, what I'm asking, the holding I'm asking for is that 3583D2 is the statutory maximum in this context, and that the merits conditions, the merits arguments were presented to the district court. You wouldn't expect the parties to say this is in violation of the statutory maximum. You would only expect them to say to the district court, this would be error or this would not be error, and not to discuss with the district court what will or will not be appealed. It's sort of like the standard of review.
Do you agree with this? Oh, 3583 basically says it's got to be relevant and least restrictive, essentially.
Yes, that's right. And so I think it's worth pausing for a moment to consider the implications of the government's argument to this court. If what the government says is correct and the court accepts it in this case, then a defendant who waives appeal, and there are many such defendants who for whatever reason see the need to do that, can be subjected to literally any condition of supervised release at all and would have no remedy for that other than modification, which the appeal of which is off the table according to United States versus Scallon, or clemency. And so nobody would describe the condition of supervised release we're talking about here today as barbaric or cruel or anything, and nobody would describe the judge here as intemperate. But think about the next defendant as well. There is no safeguard other than the statutory maximum exception in the plea agreement.
Well, isn't the beef about the condition itself?
The beef is entirely about the condition itself.
Okay, well, lots of people appeal and say, you know, this is beyond the pale, you bar me from using a computer, you know, I can't log in, you know, I can't get a job, or, you know, I mean, just get tons of appeals where people complain to say this is beyond the norm, et cetera, et cetera, but it's a straight-on attack to the conditions of probation. It's not framed as somehow being aggrieving the statutory max. So you haven't, well, is your rifle shot us embracing the argument you make about statutory max?
Yes, that is the only way to reach the merits. In this case, and it will be the only way to reach the merits in the next case where the condition of supervised release offends D3 in a much more significant way. Now, I do think this one, D2, does...
I see. So your warning is often people don't know what conditions are coming up. It ends up in the PSR.
Precisely.
And there could be quite dramatic and drastic, like no computers ever. The trouble here is, even if we get to the merits, these two are much more plain vanilla. I know you're going to push against that, but one of them is a standard condition.
That's right. It's a standard condition, and it violates D2 because it is so vague as to require both the probation officer and the defendant to guess essentially at its meaning. What the standard condition says is that you must note that if probation tells you to notify anybody of any risk at all, then you have to do what probation says.
Why can't, if the person is in doubt, why can't they ask the probation officer whether it's permissible or not? What's so onerous about that?
Well, what's onerous is that it doesn't provide any limits to the probation officer about what the probation officer's answer is in that situation. That one of the harms, as United States versus Evans explains, the Ninth Circuit case, one of the harms about vague prohibitions is that they provide essentially unlimited discretion to the person who is enforcing the condition. And so
the vagary here is the word relationship. And that's just because it's a future event. It's not until the person gets out that whatever relationships and organizations she participates in, right? Isn't the key word that you'd be focusing on to say is vague is the relationship that triggers the notification. What's the vague word?
The vague word is risk and another person. I don't think relationship is present in there at all.
But it's a risk notification to someone that she would have a relationship with.
It correct. That's right. If you say, let's interpret the condition completely literally and say any risk, any person, then the problem with that is it is plainly overbroad to say that probation can tell you to tell anybody I am a risk in any regard whatsoever.
Well, we know there was a factual finding. She got the abuse of trust enhancement, right? And we know the underlying crime, $1 million plus embezzled. So the risk notification is to make sure she doesn't steal from someone else she's close to in an employment context or any other philanthropic context.
So
how would you write it so we could limit it to that orbit? We just don't know who she's going to affiliate with.
I think that it would be a great deal clearer if you said that the defendant shall disclose her criminal conviction to any employer.
Right, but that's the employment condition. That's the second one.
That's right.
So you're saying the first one, just even though it's listed in the guidelines as a standard condition, it you want to just write it off the books?
Well, in this wording, yes. I mean, yeah, it is a challenge to the standard condition, which two courts and under a predecessor said was unconstitutionally vague in those cases. And I'm at a loss to see what the difference is between the current version and the amended version of those conditions. All the amended version does is change the word.
In all these cases, you know, once she is released, she can move to modify.
She can move to modify. It runs through the same district judge. But there is no guarantee that she will not have violated the terms of the conditions of her supervised release by failing to do that while she's waiting for a modification. It's not like, for instance, a no alcohol prohibition or some of the sex offender treatment where she can comply until it's litigated. Once the probation officer tells her to make a disclosure, she must make that disclosure or be in violation of the terms of her supervised release. And if she prevails in modification, she can't unring the bell.
You want to get to the second one?
Right. So the second one, the special condition of supervised release, says that she can not participate, or she cannot hold without notification and approval either a fiduciary position or one in which she handles property or credit. The term anything with a fiduciary relationship is vague. It is, by its terms, extremely overbroad. There is no way for her to know what that is. And the government's proposed limiting construction of that, which is that it is only positions that have control over property or credit, it cannot be what a reasonable person would think that condition means, because there is the disjunctive fiduciary or that. The term fiduciary is essentially a catch-all that can mean whatever probation decides that it ought to mean.
What's wrong with just in the 2 years that she's under supervision, she's got to tell any employer that she was convicted of a felony embezzlement? What's wrong with that?
Well, I don't concede that that would be within D2, but it would certainly be significantly better than the broad conditions that she's under right now. What's wrong with that is you look at Sunday and Holm, both of those explain that those kinds of conditions can interfere with her employment and interfere with her ability to make restitution, her ability to achieve rehabilitation, and to comply with the other conditions of supervised release that require her to have employment.
Interfere, just make it harder?
Yes.
But, okay, I have a curiosity. You probably know the PSR pretty well. The PSR indicated she had a job post-conviction, pre-sentencing, as a fraud analyst. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So that employer, faced with a conviction for $1 million embezzlement, put her in a position of ferreting out fraud. Didn't seem too troubled, so she got the job.
Some employers will do that.
Yeah.
That employer also received an anonymous note from somebody that said, that told her about the prior conviction. So it's going to be fraught for her either way. We would ask the court to just remand the case to clarify and narrow the conditions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Page. You've reserved your rebuttal time. All right, Ms. Hayward.
May it please the court, Gail Hayworth on behalf of the United States. The court should dismiss this appeal because Thomas waived her right to bring it. In her plea agreement, in exchange for the government dismissing a 9-count indictment and agreeing to a sentence of less than 36 months for a crime in which she stole more than $1.4 million from her employer, Thomas broadly waived her right to appeal her sentence, which includes the supervised release term and the conditions. Thomas received the benefit of her bargain, but now she seeks to deny the government the benefit of its bargain, the waiver of her appeal. Thomas argues that this appeal falls within an exception to that waiver, specifically the statutory maximum exception, in which she reserved the right to appeal a sentence exceeding the statutory maximum punishment. But she's wrong. That exception does not apply. She brings constitutional challenges to Standard Condition 12.
I have a threshold question. I mean, you made all these arguments to our court in your motion to dismiss, and a prior panel said no.
That's correct.
So you didn't brief whether we can reverse opinion of our panel, of our courts?
Generally, when a motion to dismiss is denied, the merits panel can consider it again when it considers the merits.
But that panel didn't carry it with the case. Most of these appeal waivers, when the government asserts and there's ambiguity, the panel carries it with the case. Here they denied the government's motion to dismiss.
They denied it, that's correct, but there is the merits panel can reconsider it and can consider whether or not the waiver applies.
I'm not familiar with any time our court has ever revisited an actual denial of a motion to dismiss, but maybe that exists. But so you would say our panel, earlier panel, made a mistake. Why?
Not necessarily that they made a mistake, but that they realized that maybe this deserved more further review.
Yeah, but that would be carrying it with the case. They denied the motion to dismiss. Both parties were required to fully brief the merits of this case.
My understanding.
So I'm asking, if that's correct, they denied the motion to dismiss, why did that panel make a mistake?
They made a mistake because the waiver clearly applies here. That's the government's position.
Do you agree with opposing counsel if the phrase stat max is ambiguous, then the waiver wouldn't apply?
If it's ambiguous, but it's not ambiguous.
And so what case do you have that applies to 3583 and says that 3583 attacks are not infringing a stat max? What's your best circuit case that actually says that?
That would be Chu case, Scallion, Prestel, Holzer.
And these are our circuits?
Chu and Scallion are our circuits. Ferguson, Holzer.
Okay, so those are just controlling authorities, you say, they answer the question.
Yes, they address the exact question before this court, which is, does a challenge to the substantive reasonableness of a supervised release condition constitute a statutory maximum challenge.
And what about his vagueness constitutional attack? Do those reach that too or not?
No, because they don't reach the merits of the conditions. But the circuit authority is unanimous that standard condition 12 is not vague. Many circuits have upheld it against vagueness challenges. The only circuit that has vacated it is the second, and it did so on improper delegation grounds, which this court has already held that it's not an improper delegation in Mejia.
But we can get to the merits in a minute. I thought the Seventh Circuit had trouble with the predecessor version of
That's right, the predecessor, but has not had trouble.
Because you devoted over half your brief to waiver, which means no review whatsoever, even if there's an error. So that's, to me, somewhat disturbing to begin with, but it is appellate waiver law. It's a bargain, no one can predict, but then it may turn out there's an egregious error. The government, in its discretion, could then not assert the waiver, but here you are asserting it. That's your prerogative. But here's my broad question about all these waivers. That's still just a contract between you two. It doesn't bind our court. Do you agree? I mean, think about it carefully. You've negotiated a contract. If you think by pressing the appeal they're violating the contract, the relief you would have would be to say they breached it. You go to trial. The fact that you two contract something, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't in any way bind us. We can, in our discretion, reach the merits. Do you agree with that or not?
Under this court's precedent, no, I would disagree with that. If you're following your court's precedent, that if it's within the waiver, you enforce the waiver.
Well, we do enforce it, but what case can you say? You understand my question. Independent of the courts, in fact, Rule 11 doesn't even allow the courts to be involved in your plea. You're saying the parties can negotiate and bind an appellate court? Or is it just an agreement where we can choose to dismiss, but we always have discretion to reach the merits? I would think it's the latter, but if you're confident there's a case that says it isn't, I'd like to know that case.
I don't know if there's a case that has specifically addressed the issue you are talking about. It's more that the court recognizes the importance of enforcing the bargain and how it's important for the entire process.
Right, but if they're in breach of it, you can say, deal's off. We're going to recharge you with all the counts. That's your remedy. It's not telling us that you two have negotiated so we can't even look at an issue that we think is undecided or difficult.
Generally, I think in like contract disputes, when parties come to the court and ask you to enforce the bargain, the court enforces the bargain.
We can, but you understand, well, okay. I think it's a larger conceptual issue. I think the law is very undecided out there, and I think my understanding of where our court is if we think there's a miscarriage that's going to happen, we can overlook the waiver. It's not our deal. The government can press it and reindict, get it, you know, the bargain's off. But the government doesn't have any power to bind us not to look at an issue. I think that's where the law is, but.
Following up on Judge Higgins' point, though, we have cases that definitely underpin wanting to embrace appeal waivers. And unless something's unconscionable or against public policy, where's the cases that we have said we're not enforcing those?
Correct.
Isn't that correct?
That's correct. I mean, this court's analysis generally to look at the waiver, was it knowingly and voluntarily entered? And then look at the waiver language, does it cover this appeal? If it does, then it enforces the waiver. Now turning to the defendant's argument,
another question that gnaws at me because we get a lot of these appeal waivers. Is this sort of boilerplate language that was used here?
Yes, this is standard waiver language.
I kind of figured because it is annoying, which is my word. You can get these boilerplated language in there, and then when the other side, you know, protests and somebody just put the macro in it, you know, then we're up here struggling with some that had the government taking more time to tailor the language to the particular defendant. And as one who once toiled in your shoes, you know, I don't embrace the notion that the government is overworked to tailor the appeal waiver other than a template so it's foolproof. that it's nailed down. I'm not talking about some like next term, but, you know, we get these boilerplate ones and the other side says no. And then the government says, you know, I'm from the government. This is what he agreed to. Yeah, that's true. But I'm unpersuaded that the government is overburdened to tailor it, you know, like we do. I mean, we don't macro it in a particular case, particularly like this, where, you know, you got a lot of money, 1.5, these white collar criminal ones in particular. I'm not making a speech, I guess I'm just, you don't have to answer this, but I said I'm annoyed that the government doesn't take the time to tailor the macro to fit with specific language so that the defendant is well aware, you know, what they're waving, blah, blah, blah. And then we're not up here dancing around the pen to figure out does it cover and so forth. So that's just kind of an institutional concern, if you get my point.
Mm-hmm. Are you taking issue with the macro of special condition one? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, not so much this, but just the language that just strikes me in an individual case, it's pretty easy to use words that at least lend themselves less to the notion of being vague, where you got a specific defendant, 1.5 million or whatever it is. It's a white collar crime. They're getting, what, 36 months? So they're going to be on the bricks, which means that the special conditions are going to apply for a good period of time. And it may be different in a case where somebody's getting, you know, 50 years in jail. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? But I guess my worry is just these white collar ones in particular, where the conditions do become, so we get them in the, you can't be on the internet or these other things, you know, not like don't use drugs and alcohol, et cetera, but these that seem to be somewhat tailored to the specifics because the person is going to go out and seek employment. You find what I'm saying? It just strikes me that the macro just doesn't work in every case. You may end up with us affirming it, but it doesn't mean that to me there wasn't a better way so that the defendant does clearly know what they borrowed from. That's all I'm saying.
Yes, the macro doesn't work in every case, but here it fit like a glove.
Okay.
I mean, she abused a position of trust, a fiduciary capacity position, and she used personal financial information of others to commit the crime. So here, the macro fit her like a glove.
I mean, opposing counsel points out the expanse of the rule you might be asking us to announce by trying to end this case at the waiver, and it is a little like what I think Judge Stewart's questions are. What would you say if instead of these conditions, the condition of probation were that she has to pay a non-victim of the charged offense restitution? That's an unlawful sentence, clear.
Right.
It's not consistent with the statutes or Supreme Court law. So I could easily see someone thinking, well, wait, I didn't bargain away that. I never thought I had to pay this victim. That's a violation of stat max.
Well, the government's position, it's not a violation of the stat max.
Not in these two. But let's imagine the court had said to her, you know what, instead of just the employer you embezzled from, I think I want you to pay this philanthropic society I like. She's stuck with that? He just comes up with that at sentencing?
Well, it's a separate question of whether or not it falls within the stat max or whether or not there's another reason to appeal. And in that case, the court would have to look at it closely to determine whether or not the waiver applied in that case. But
well,
there are very good reasons.
The only exception is stat max, but it does sound like that condition of probation wouldn't be consistent with the statute. So to me, I see ambiguity. And here we've got other conditions. As Judge Stewart said, what if just out of the blue, the judge had said you can never use the internet the rest of your life? The government would be here saying, stuck with that, even though it has nothing to do with the crime? Is that your position? Because they bargained it away to get the deal?
Well, there's other backstops to those unauthorized.
Well, what's the big backstop?
The big backstop is that the defendant can always move to modify. And then the other one is that if there are changed circumstances and the court denies the motion to modify, the defendant can appeal that.
You're talking about 2 years from now, yeah, when she gets out.
Time problem.
This is the nature of a waiver. In a prison context, you can argue that the sentence was unreasonable, and under a very similar analysis here to 3583D, 3553 is a reasonable analysis, and he waives the right to attack the reasonableness of it.
But at the guilty plea, everyone knows what the prison times are going to be. Those are right there in the code. Everyone knows what the fines are going to be. People even know the guideline range. They have no idea what's going to happen with conditions for probation. That's going to wait until the PSR. So inherently, when you negotiate these pleas, conditions of probation are going to be surprises.
At the time of the plea, they're not necessarily, like, you have notice of what the standard conditions are, and that was one of them here. The special condition one was not probably a surprise to her.
You can tell I'm probably with you on these conditions. They're pretty predictable. They're standard. I don't frankly see much. We'll hear opposing counsel back up, but I'm very worried about the myriad crazy conditions that get imposed. And if the government's position today here is stuck with it.
Well, there's the backstop of the limitation of what we say the stat max is for supervised release, which is the time length. So that is always a backstop. There's an expiration date for every condition, and that's a backstop. The other backstop is, and I know you have questioned it, but they could, in addition, I mean, it's something that you don't even have for a prison sentence, which is that you can always seek to modify. You can always seek to challenge it. That's, you're not giving up that right with an appeal waiver. So you have these two backstops that are important to the reasonableness of a supervised release condition. In addition, you have the other backstop that if circumstances change, then you have the right to appeal. So there's lots of backstops here to protect.
I know, but we all know the bail to jail problem. They get out, they didn't think it was covered, they get violated, revoked, and they're back in jail again, and life falls apart. And you're saying, well, they could eventually get an appeal and maybe get it won. I'm not sure I'm comfortable saying we can just all kick the can down the road.
In another backstop too, are there other ones, is that for unauthorized orders, such as like where you're ordering the defendant to pay restitution to someone that's not a victim, those are cases where the court clearly does not have authority. One, the court is probably more likely to correct itself if notified of that error. Two, it is very questionable that the government would ever stand on its waiver in those circumstances. Three, when the court is acting outside of its authority, clearly outside of the bounds that Congress has provided for it, it is unlikely that that order is going to be, like, for example, if you're talking about terms of prison confinement, like, the BOP is not going to treat that order as binding. So it's not going to be really effectual anyways for a lot of those circumstances.
Because Stewart's right. I mean, appeal waivers were creatures of the government, and you have huge leverage. And now I think most pleas, they're not even permitted to plea unless they waive their rights to appeal. A lot of offices are like that. So it seems to me it's on the government to tailor. If you really don't want any review of probation conditions, why not just put that in explicitly instead of this uncertain phrase, stat max?
Well, here we felt like we did put it in explicitly.
But you don't explicitly say anything about probation conditions. As simple as this includes probation conditions.
The way the case law is and the way the plea agreement is that it's the stat max does not include probation conditions because the maximum penalties for the offense listed the maximum penalty as the term length, not any conditions. So the government believed that the plea agreement was clear as to the conditions don't fall in the stat max.
If we get to the employment condition, if I remember, the objection at sentencing was she didn't want to disclose. That seems to me a strained reading. But I'm not sure if this district judge imposed any explained or justified why the probation officer would have veto power, even if she does disclose. Am I right that the employment condition doesn't require her only to disclose it, but it even then additionally gives probation a veto power?
That's correct.
Okay, did the district court justify that veto power given to a member of the judiciary? Did the district court say anything at sentencing as to why that's needed?
No, because it wasn't given an opportunity. She only objected based on the employer awareness requirement. She voiced no objection to the probation officer approval requirement, so the court was never given an opportunity to address that.
We should review that for plain error if we
reach it. Exactly, yes. And it's not plain error because there's very good reasons why you would want that additional protection. Because the employer, yes, can be trusted to protect its own interests, but in cases where there are other third-party interests involved, like where she may have access to the personal financial information of others, not the employer, then it's reasonable to have the other backstop, the other check of the probation officer approval.
Okay.
So if the court has no further questions, we ask you to affirm. Thank you.
All right, thank you, ma'am. Appreciate it. All right, Mr. Page, you've reserved your rebuttal.
May it please the court, I don't agree that the challenge to the special condition is inadequately preserved. The penultimate sentence in that objection is requiring employer notification needlessly lumps in employers who opt out with those that do not and erects unnecessary barriers for Thomas to earn a respectable limit to respectable living post.
That's just preserving in district court the disclosure requirement. I didn't see any objection to the veto power.
Well, it's an objection to the entire condition, and the entire condition imposes both disclosure and a probation veto power, and the objection to all of it is that it imposes unnecessary barriers to employment. Certainly, having probation decide whether or not you are able to work somewhere at all is an unnecessary barrier to employment post-imprisonment. I want to warn the court not to rely on modification as a backstop or a safeguard against unreasonably severe conditions of supervised release. Modification goes through the same judge. And this court held in United States versus Scallon that if the defendant executes a standard waiver, that judge's decision not to decline to modify the conditions of supervised release is subject to the waiver. So there is essentially no safeguard against a wildly unreasonable condition of supervised release under these terms other than the statutory maximum exception, which fortunately fits very well to a challenge to conditions of the severity of conditions of supervised release. 3583D2 is the only and terminal limit about how severe conditions of supervised release may be, and therefore it is the maximum. It defines the maximum of severity that is possible.
You're saying if the defendant went back before Judge Godbee, he could just say, King's X, you waive this. Is that what you're saying?
If the defendant went back before,
you know, to complain about the conditions, to get the judge to modify, et cetera, you're saying that Judge Godbee could just say you waived that. That's in the waiver, as opposed to the judge taking a fresh look at it. Is that what you're saying?
The judge could do that. Judge Godbee is not, you know, ordinarily the concern, the person we're worried about here. But in this case, we're saying that
you must know our law better than I do. But I'm surprised at that. If a motion to modify is covered by an appeal waiver?
United States versus Scallon.
All right, well, look at that. That's strange.
Yeah. I think, best I can tell, United States versus Scallon says, appears to analogize it to an unauthorized collateral attack.
I see.
That's the best reading I can give for it. And
you heard my question. Before your time runs out, you may not even agree. You may be with the government because, of course, one view of appeal waivers, I would say, is they can say you've breached and they can just charge your client. Am I right or am I wrong?
I'm so glad you asked. I do agree with the government about that.
It binds us. The waivers bind us.
Well, there may be a miscarriage exception that comes from somewhere else. This court hasn't said either way. But I think the assumption that we have been working under is that a waiver of appeal isn't a promise not to appeal. A waiver of appeal is an agreement that we will lose if we are within the terms of the waiver. And it would be fairly terrifying for me to say, to a client, to have to say to a client, if we're wrong about the scope of the waiver, then we're going to undo your plea.
What about our body of law that says we pretermit the waiver because we're going to decide the merits? All that case law would be wrong.
I don't think that case law would be wrong. It would just be saying that your agreement that you automatically lose under the waiver is not necessarily something that we have to address here because you would lose otherwise.
Okay.
So,
this is back to the point. It's a contract between the government and you.
Yeah. And we're asking.
If we choose not to untangle what you didn't clearly define and go to the merits and say, King's X, even if you lose on the merit. I mean, I think we do that fairly nimbly in lots of cases that we just look past the whole waiver issue and go to the merits and just say, okay, we assume without deciding that you didn't waive it, we look at the merits, you lose, we affirm. I mean, we got lots of per curiam opinions that just say that, don't they?
They do, and I don't think there's anything inconsistent about that that outcome with the view that I think that we have of the waiver, which is that it determines the outcome on appeal if it is within the waiver, and so it need not determine the outcome because there's another route to the outcome. That's a perfectly logical explanation for those cases.
All right. Well, you got my attention. You don't have to answer this. I specifically said Judge Guy because he's the judge in this case. And then when you said, well, we're not particularly worried about Judge Godman, then that sounds to me like, you know, you're trying to make hay beyond this case, but boy, that's why I asked you what's the holding you want us to make. And, you know, it sounds to me like it's past what might happen to her with Judge Godman, but you want us to pronounce in two tablets something that's going to cover other judges who may or may not be there. You don't have to respond to that. That's my iteration that I got from what's the deal here. But anyway, there's a reason why we kept the case on for oral argument. It has very interesting issues, as you should be able to tell on it. But we've got your argument and your brief, and we'll look at the cases that you've cited, both of you here, to help us with figuring out the right outcome. So thank you both for your oral argument. The case will be submitted. All right, we call up the second.